You said that the book isn't the book that you necessarily set out to write, and it was, or maybe it is, but it's not the book maybe that your publisher, your editor thought you were going to write, but it's a book that you have come to. What had you set out to write? What was your goal when you first set out to write this book?
Well, the book came about because after my last book, my editor said, I want you to think about a book-length adventure you can go on. And so I did some thinking about that because that's just the kind of thing I love to hear. So I thought, well, I could dog sled to the North Pole, or I could sail around Turkey, or, you know, it was that sort of suggestion. And then I was driving home from Davis. I teach sometimes at UC Davis, and there's always this great moment when I get over to the what I call the leashless side of the Sierras, and the dogs were in the car and everybody was happy, and I just thought, oh wait, like the ranch is my book-length adventure. Like that's the unexpected thing I did. It would be completely expected for me to dog sled to the North Pole. But to buy a ranch and to commit to something for, well, now all time, because I just put it in a land trust, but to commit to something that was going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of heartache and a lot of sitting still, which is not my normal pose, that was the unexpected thing. And so I wrote the proposal and she accepted it. How it changed over time was really the addition of my mother. My agent read an early draft and said to me, isn't this the book where you really talk about what happened to you as a child? And I said, God, have I been doing anything but that all this time? Like, it seems like that's all I've written about. And she said, no, you haven't. You've put it in metaphor, you've put it in dream, you've put it in image. That's not the same as writing directly at it. And so I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. So that came in, you know, what is the ranch a respite from, basically. And then, you know, over the course of this 6 or 8 years of writing it, just my dawning awareness of climate change and of the destruction of the wilderness, and really going from a very naive stance thinking, oh, well, there's somewhere that's still wild, you know, to really realizing there's not. There's no place anymore that we can't get into. And even in the Arctic now, because of the shrinking of the sea ice. So, like, there's nowhere an oil tanker can't go, you know? And so just realizing that for me to write this book about how great it is that I have this little piece of paradise, you know, that happens to be at 9,000 feet and will be the last valley to go under, you know, in America, like, it was unconscionable to write that story without addressing climate change and the destruction of the planet and how to be with a dying planet and how we can hold the joy and the sorrow simultaneously. So that was the evolution of the book over time.
And you really do write about climate change, and it seems that, and you write about this because you teach writing as well, of course.
Yeah.
And how people write about climate change, and do we write about it with a sense of despair that the world, of course, we are destroying it, or do we write about it with a sense of hope to say we can do something and let's celebrate what we have, even though we're destroying it? I mean, it does seem like there's a debate that's happening either internally for you or maybe even just amongst writers in general. How do we write about this?
Well, it's tricky business. And what I came to, I mean, there's a moment in the book where I talked to an earth scientist and he says to me, well, the future of the earth looks very, very grim in the 100-year frame. In the 500-year frame, it looks quite a bit better. He said there won't be hardly any people yet left, but the ones who are here will have learned a great deal. And that's, you know, to me, that was hopeful, actually. I mean, obviously, the suffering that will happen between now and then, but it was a kind of hopeful thought. But what I came to in my writing about it and writing around it and writing toward it in this book was really, like, the essential question for me, not being a scientist, isn't can we save it or not? The essential question for me is, like, what kind of person am I if I turn my back on it, even if we can't? you know, if we leave the earth off at the vet and let him put the dog down, you know, instead of being there with the dog's head in our lap. I mean, like, you know, we're such more interesting people if we continue to sing about the beauty that's left, even if the ship's going down, as opposed to just, you know, jumping off and looking at our screens all day.
So one of the themes in the book that we touch upon with climate change, but it comes in other things, is you're trying to hold hope and grief together. Like, how can you feel both of those at once? And as a writer, and in this book, you that's what you're trying to do. You might be, maybe you're grieving over the planet. Maybe you're grieving over one of your animals. Maybe you're grieving over your mother. But at the same time, as you say in the book, you're trying to hold your heart open.
Right. And that is, I mean, that is the challenge. It's probably in this room, there are people who are my Facebook friends. And if you are, you know that I might lose a dog, like, in the next 48 hours. And it's like the universe said to me, okay, miss, hold the hope and joy, you know, hold the hope and sorrow simultaneously. How's this for an acid test on your first week of your book tour? And I mean, it is, like, that is the challenge. And I mean, you know, probably that's just being a grown up. I mean, I think we spend a certain few decades of our lives, if we're raised with a certain amount of privilege in certain communities, thinking that, you know, oh, the good thing will just keep happening, you know? And then you get to a certain age and you realize that's not so, because you see people die and things you love die. So for me, you know, the climate change question, how to, I mean, I was in the Eastern Canadian Arctic, as I mentioned, and I got to be in a boat next to 800 narwhal, you know, which is as an astonishing a thing as has ever happened to me. And a lot of astonishing shit has happened to me. But that was right up there. And yet, you know, I'm standing there seeing these narwhal, knowing that the sea ice is going to be lost, and that they're a population that is even more threatened than the polar bear by the loss of the sea ice, because they use it to hunt. The next day, we come upon this glorious thing we at first think is an island, and then it just turns out to be ice. But it's 5 miles by 5 miles, and it has these mountain ranges and rivers pouring off of it because of the erosion. Well, it's the piece of the Greenland ice shelf that fell off. It's just floating around out there. It's gotten a lot smaller. It's still, like, one of the most magnificent things you'll ever see, but you can't look at it without thinking, oh, there it is again, you know? And for me, that's really related, I have realized, in the course of writing this book, to my ability to love myself in spite of my father's physical and sexual abuse. Those are not unrelated ideas, and they come together in the book. Like I had to figure out a way to love my damaged self, right? That's the goal of therapy, isn't it? But certainly from, you know, an abusive childhood, and completely related to this idea of loving the earth, you know. I mean, when I talk about it, it sounds so like philosophy 101, you know, or philosophy for dummies, really. But it's, you know, that's where the book took me, was to seeing those two things in relation to each other.
Well, you open up, the book ends a lot on the climate change, like the narwhal passages towards the end, and right. There's an increasing awareness of this. But the book does open with your father's abuse, and with your mother's, wasn't physical abuse, but it was certainly, you know, just what you read, you know, she was abusing you. And you were very brutally honest about this. And what was that as an experience as a writer? How do you feel about that now? And why was it important for you to do it?
I mean, the first thing I'd like to say is, like I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts. I've taught writers who've had terrible things happen to them all my life. Like, I consider my abuse like maybe a 4 on a 1 to 10 scale. You know, we always had enough to eat. You know, I mean, there was bad things that happened, and if you read the book, you'll read about them. But I don't feel special. You know, let me say that. It would be impossible to be a writing teacher in America and feel special about the abuse. It's I had a writing teacher a long time ago who said, you can't swing a dead cat anymore without running into an abuse story. And, you know, it's terrible, the things writing teachers say. It's a terrible burden to be a writing teacher because, you know, like, I know I've said something, like, not like that, but I've said something to someone that made them not write something for a long time. And I actually think I didn't write directly at it, not to protect myself, not to protect my parents who have both been gone a while, not because of shame or any of that. I think I was afraid to be boring or common because of what that teacher said. And so I think getting at it actually felt good. You know, I didn't have to go to the bathroom and puke. Like I didn't, it didn't cause me great distress to write it. I just thought, oh, really? Like somebody would be interested in that? And then I did my very first interview about this book several months ago. And that was all the woman talked about, was the abuse. And, you know, the abuse takes up, what, like 10, 15% of the book. I mean, it's
probably not even.
Probably not even. I mean, it's really just a matter of paragraphs, right? And that was all she talked about. And I thought, oh, God, what have I done? I'm going on the abuse tour. but I guess, you know, it feels like if I wrote about it in a way that people respond to, I'll feel great about that because it happens to so many people in America and, I mean, all over the world, but in America. And I think, you know, it's relation to, I mean, the last line of the book, spoiler alert, it doesn't ruin it. The last line of the book is, you know, my mother always said, I don't even want to see you till dinner. And so she freed me to go out and love the earth. And that's, you know, I've been asked a lot. Well, actually, people have said to me, you know, oh, like you've accomplished all this stuff with the abuse. And can you imagine what you would have done if you hadn't been? And I go, no, that's not how it works. Like if I had really nice parents, I might be an asshole. Like I might be. Like I, you know, would I be a writer? Would I have compassion? Would I be so excited when my students' stories get out into the world? You know, who knows who I'd be? And one of the things I came to in the writing was, like, you know, I had parents, two of them, who really, really didn't want to be parents and really didn't want me, but that's not the worst thing, you know? It's not. Like, it gave me the opportunity to find a much better parenting from the Rockies, you know, from the mountains, from the rivers, and, you know, I don't feel disadvantaged because of it, and I also feel like, who would I even be without that story? I don't know.
So in the chapter you read, and there's other chapters in the book like that, you use the word braiding. You know, so on one level, you're talking about putting UV protection on the logs. You know, on the other, you're talking about your mother in the peasant skirt, and you're talking about depression. What's your process there? I mean, if you separate them out completely, they don't necessarily have to go together, but when you do it, it seems to really work. How do you know what needs to go with what, or is it just intuitive?
All my work I really see as an infinite number of infinitely divisible pieces. That's how I've always worked. It's how I feel work. It's how I approach it. I mean, you know this because you've studied with me, but I collect what I call glimmers. I collect these pieces of the physical world. I pay attention when I'm out in the physical world with my senses, and I collect these hunks of the physical world. So one hunk is me putting that wire brush down the chimney. Another hunk is that skirt. That little story about that skirt, that has been written into and cut from like four books, you know, prior till now. Also, when my mother goes to see her shake her father's hand. That's another scene that's been floating around in my computer for 20 years, honestly. So that's how I approach work. I approach work as an infinite number of infinitely divisible pieces. And that essay that I just read, it came together very late, and it was basically the cast-offs from the other chapters, essentially. And then I could just feel the way, you know, slapping that UV sealant on the logs when it was absolutely impossible to follow the directions, it just felt a lot like everything else. You know, it just did. It felt like a metaphor that was going to be really flexible, you know, really flexible. And so it became, you know, the kind of spine of that essay. And then I could do the other pieces kind of along the spine of the UV protection. And also, like, when I wrote the line, you know, fall was the most dangerous season of my childhood home, like, that's when the essay started to cohere.
It almost feels like jazz to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you've got these themes or these pieces, and the way you're weaving them together, it's like suddenly, like, there's the saxophone solo right when you wanted it, you know? And I feel like that's a real talent and something very interesting in your writing, in that you are sort of juggling or braiding or however you want to say it, but you seem to go back to them right at the right moment.
Well, I appreciate that. That's a huge compliment. But and you said something, you said, or is it just intuitive? And I would just take the just out of that sentence. I mean, it is intuitive, but it's not simply intuitive. It's intuitive. It's like informed intuitiveness or something like that. Like, because I do it by feel, but then I have to be able to make sense. I'll say, oh, well, I would have to, after the fact, describe why it worked to myself if it's going to stay that way. Does that make sense?
And the two stories contrast so well as well, because you really see then the ranch as your haven, as the place that you have peace.
Right.
When you flash back to the awful abuse that you had, emotional, everything that your mom, and then of course physical and sexual with your dad. And so what really struck me throughout the whole book was your relationship with the ranch, your 2-decade-long relationship with the ranch. And you travel so much, and I know that you're away almost as much as you're actually at the ranch. And so when you're away from the ranch, what's your relationship to it? I mean, are you constantly missing it? Or, you know, is it a different relationship when you're there and when you're not there?
I miss the ranch when I'm not there, but I'm a traveler, you know? And so the ranch is the place I miss. Like, none of my other places do I go, oh, if only I could just have a few days. And none of my other places, and when I say that, what I mean by that is, like, places that I go teach every year. I've come to really love Santa Fe because I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Like, I never sit around and go, oh, I wish I had a day in Santa Fe, you know, though I enjoy it there. I enjoy going to the Arctic, obviously. Who wouldn't? I enjoy, you know, even Davis sometimes for certain reasons, but not for very long. But I mean, I love to teach, and teaching necessitates that I leave the ranch, and teaching is at the center of my life, and it's so important. I also love sushi. I like movies. I like things that are not accessible where I live. So, but I do, I mean, the biggest thing is just guilt, you know, and I talk about that in the book, like guilt if something goes wrong, if I've left a house sitter with a problem, as I have this week, if somebody's sick or dying, and I can't get there. I mean, mostly I can. And for the last few nights, I've been, like, driving to Santa Fe, driving back to Creed, driving to Vail, driving back to Creed. Like, I've, because of my dog. So tonight I'm staying put. But, you know, so it's more like I feel irresponsible. But it is not true that I don't relish the opportunity to re-enter the world of sushi and bookstores and movies and, you know, people who are more my kind. And you know, the people in Creed are wonderful people. It's a little different living there with Trump as president. I mean, we've had, you know, lots of Republican presidents, and so it's always a little different, but this is more different. It's a little more, I feel a little more alien.
Yeah, you don't really talk too much about politics in discussion with your neighbors in the book. But is that a reality? Because I did wonder about that.
Well, Creed is about two-thirds Republican, one-third Democrat. It's not, you know, and the things that people say in Creed are sort of more like, well, it matters more who we elect for school board than president, you know, which is a certain way of being in the world. There, people are kind to each other. People are respectful of each other's politics. I haven't had a single incident of ugliness of any kind like that, political ugliness. It's just a feeling, and it's mostly not Creed people. Like this hunting season, I was in bed and I woke up one morning and I heard this chug, 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 chug of a diesel engine. And I looked out my window and I have a long driveway and there were just a bunch of hunters sitting in my driveway, like waiting for it to get light, like waiting to see if something walked past that they could shoot. And like, I'm not anti-hunting, but I'm really not. But like, I thought, okay, like here's a truck full of dudes
that you don't know,
that I don't know, and they're in my driveway, and I'm like the only person in Creed who really speaks out politically. That's a true fact. And so like, what if they knew that? And like, why are they in my driveway when there's a whole national forest behind me? And maybe they're, you know, gonna come, you know. So, and those are not thoughts I have ever had in Creed before now. So that's how it's different. Nothing bad has happened, but it's just a different way of feeling when there's six dudes in camouflage in your yard at 4:30 in the morning. Like, it's a different set of feelings about that.
Well, I was struck by, you know, you have these little, in between the bigger chapters, these little shorter essays, and sometimes they're about animals, sometimes they're about people who've helped you in Creed. And the people in Creed have in this book, have really stepped up and helped you in a way. And the Absolutely. People who have harmed you, the two most notable scenes, are people you've brought in to sit at the ranch.
That's true.
And I wonder if you could talk about, and you said at the end of the second one, where they one guy, you know, eating Phoebe, I believe, is the chapter. So you can imagine if this ranch sitter is on your ranch with a bunch of animals and you have a chapter called Eating Phoebe, it's probably not going to go well. You know, how do you decide who comes on the ranch? How and it must feel like a real violation when you've trusted somebody to be on the ranch and then you come back and you've got a problem.
Well, the Eating Phoebe incident sort of changed how carefully I chose who came to the ranch. I will say that. What happens in Eating Phoebe is that one of my ranch sitters gets drunk with a few of his buddies and decides to slaughter one of my sheep and eat it and bone it out and eat it. I think they were having some sort of ritual, some kind of manly ritual. And in the meantime, he let another, a very young lamb out. So that lamb got taken by coyotes and they killed a chicken too, which must have been part of the evening. But anyway, that was a sobering moment for me. I had him as my ranch sitter because I had had his mother as my ranch sitter and she was awesome and she couldn't do it the next winter, and she said he could do it. So I kind of backed into that in a not very careful way, and I learned my lesson. But in that essay, I find myself in the position where I have to kill a ram about 2 years later. And it's a real moment of self-implication. It's like, well, I haven't even gotten done being mad at this guy for killing a sheep, and here I am killing a sheep. So, now I take a lot more care in choosing them, and it has become, and this is a really important part of my life now, it's become a kind of unofficial writing residency at the ranch, and I teach in two graduate programs, so I have a sort of unending number of students who work on a book while they're in the program, and then they need another year or two to finish the book, and it's become a really rich part of my life because I don't have children, but I have like 25, 25-year-olds who like come for Thanksgiving now because they've all been ranch sitters and they get to be there and finish their work and help me with the animals.
Well, that's one thing that I was struck by in the book is your relationship to these younger writers. When I was on the ranch, it was probably 1994, 95, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And you were obviously a figure, we loved you and you were the writing teacher, but you also kind of were mixing it up with us because you're similar age. Uh-huh. But now the relationship seems to be changing where you seem to be more of a mentor to younger writers. And sure. I wonder if you could speak to that. And if I was wondering also if you're being so brutally honest about your abuse, will have people see you or even bond to you in a different way as, you know, having seen what you've gone through and being willing to talk to you about that?
I think that people who are abused in certain ways, especially children of alcoholics, like recognize each other the second they walk through the door. I know I do. And I can tell by the way they chop vegetables or by the way they put their coat on. I mean, I can. And so that hasn't really changed. You know, me being more direct about it, like it was always in the work and the people who saw it. And so I've always had students drawn to me who have those kinds of histories. And I think they have always felt safe-ish, you know, with me. In terms of my mentoring and my mothering of these young people, like it's my sweet spot. Like I would have sucked at the diapers and all of that, but like I can make a 24-year-old believe in herself. Like just give me 6 months, you know, and that's so rewarding. And the voices that I'm working with at both Davis and IA, these voices coming out into the world, like It is honestly true. It is truly true that like when their books come out, like to me that's just as meaningful as this anymore. Like it's so exciting. You know, I have a lot of hope in the young writers and the young farmers and the Parkland kids, and like I have a lot of hope in young people. And I mean, like those Parkland kids might destroy the NRA. They really might. And, you know, again, not against hunting, not against guns, just against corruption. And I just feel like that's where it is. Like, that's where the hope is. So the time I spend, and I spend a lot of time with their manuscripts, you know, I have about 10 thesis students a year between the two programs. That's a lot of reading, and it's a lot of work, but it's really valuable work to me.
And do you feel a huge responsibility then when you are playing such a huge role in these young writers' lives? Because you mentioned you had a writing teacher who said you can swing a cat without reading an abuse story, but you also had a really negative experience. You were so close to finishing your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think was that Cowboys Are My Weakness, when that got published, your PhD, the professors there in Utah were horrible to you. So you're like, forget it. I mean, so you've been on the receiving end.
I have.
Of when writing teachers are bad.
Right.
Go bad. So, I mean, do you feel a sense of responsibility that even, you know, one word or one, you know, phrase that could be taken the wrong way?
I feel a tremendous responsibility. And I walk out of a room where I've been too harsh and oh my God, it follows me forever. It does. I'm very conscious and I still make mistakes because it's such a vulnerable situation. It's vulnerable on both sides. And sometimes, like, I'll misread a student, not really the ones I work with for months and months, but if I have, like, a week-long workshop, I'll misread a student and think, oh, they want me to really go hard, but they didn't, you know? And sure, I had a teacher at Utah who, the first day of workshop for the first semester of the creative PhD, walked in and said, no mountains, no snow, no skis, no
menstruation.
No, that's not the way he said it. No mountains, no snow, no skis, no trees, no eyes, and no female bodily excretion. And so then I wrote Cowboys Are My Weakness, which is an aria to all of those things. Heavy on the female bodily excretion. So that was Utah, yeah. So one of the reasons that I'm so invested in teaching and why I do so much of it and why I directed the program at Davis for 13 years, who wants to be the director of a creative writing program? No one. But the reason that I did it for that long was because I was like, I was trying to make up for the sorts of places I found myself in.
Now you do say you have hope when you see the young next generation.
Completely. Tommy Orange, Ramona's here, we were both his teacher, and you know Tommy Orange who wrote There, There, Buy It Tomorrow if you haven't, but you know, just the, what's happened to that book, that that voice is now in the world. I mean, that's as an important voice as anybody you can name. James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, I mean, name it, you know. Louise Erdrich, like that's a big, important literary voice and came out of our little program. And, and you know, Therese Myatt wrote a book called Heartberries. Jake Skeets has a book of poems. Like all these books by Native writers, you know, that program was created to sort of hopefully create a renaissance of Native American writers, and it's really working. There's 19 books published out of that program in 5 years. It's amazing.
And are you seeing how those young writers, and particularly the Native writers, are writing about the environment and writing about climate change? You know, we talked about earlier that, you know, how do we write about this catastrophe that we've created and are living through? Are you seeing new ways of writing about the earth and climate change coming through these young voices?
I am. There's climate fiction that I just read an article about, you know, which is sort of apocalyptic fiction that focuses on the climate. I mean, I see two things at once. You know, I do see a lot of, I always walk into my classes and I say, okay, how many people like have spent 10 nights on the ground in their life, you know, and there used to be like 7 and now there's like 1 or 0. And so I do see like a, you know, there's a lot of students, especially at Davis, like I could say elk and they wouldn't even have a mental picture, you know. But I do think, I mean, I think it's so much in our faces, the art's going to reflect that. And at IA, you know, there's a lot of students who live in remote places, so nature is a lot more present in their work than my students at Davis. And of course, you know, culturally, a lot of the Native students grow up that way, with more attention to nature. Not all of them. There's, of course, urban Indians there too.
So you talk so much of your book and your writing, not just this, but your whole life, is really about the animals, the wolfhounds, and now the horses, and the sheep, and the donkeys, and we've talked some about the mountains and being healed by the mountains, but what's the relationship with animals as, not compared, but what do you, you know, it seems like animals were a key part to you getting past that childhood and getting to where you are now.
Sure. Animals have taught me everything, you know, really. They've taught me how to die. They've taught me how to be with the dying. They've taught me how to play. They've taught me how to trust. And, you know, my dogs, I've written a lot about dogs, and, you know, dogs are really primary relationships for me. They have led me to be able to trust people. But also, you know, the non-cuddly animals, like, I've learned a lot from them. I've learned a lot from my sheep, quite honestly. I have Icelandic sheep, and they have big horns, and the rams just break everything. You know, like, and they try to break your kneecaps, you know, like, it's like rams are called rams for a good reason. And I've learned a lot about power and protection, and there's so many things to be learned from animals. And the donkeys, I should just tell the donkey story. Okay, so here's something I learned from my animals. I have two mini donkeys, Isaac and Simon, and I got them, brought them home, rescued them, brought them home, and the dogs, who are a little taller than them, were
like they thought they were their squeaky toys. Like they thought, wow, you've outdone yourself. And so at first, I wanted everybody to kind of exist in the yard together. That was my idea. And they would try, but then somebody would run and somebody would chase. And it sort of got to the point where somebody was going to break their leg if I didn't get a hold of it. So I spent a couple weeks trying to make it work out because I didn't want to lock the donkeys up in the pasture. I wanted them to have free reign. I had to go to the valley, the San Luis Valley, to buy a bunch of stuff. And so I left the horses and the donkeys in the yard, and I left the dogs in the house. And I come home like 4 hours later with a truck full of stuff, and DeSeo, my Pasifino, is running back and forth and back and forth along the fence line, whinnying and whinnying and whinnying, and he's like my alarm clock. So I think, oh, God, somebody's dead. So I come flying up the driveway, and everything seems calm, and I catch DeSeo, and he seems calm, and there's the donkeys just grazing like nothing to see here. And I park the car, I get my first pile of groceries, and I go up on what's called the dog porch, which is how I get into the house. And that's the dog porch. There's a bunch of dog beds. It's where the dogs eat. I mean, they do come in the house. They have free reign of everything, but that's their hangout area. And the donkeys have clip-clopped on their little hooves up on, like, the three steps up onto the dog porch. And they have shit on every corner of the dog porch. They have picked up the dog beds with their teeth and flung them out into the yard. They have shit in an open cooler that's sitting on the dog porch. And it was like they had a band of fraternity brothers helping them because it's, or they had saved up. But how could they have known that that was the day I would go? It was the most amazing, I mean, there was shit smeared on the railings. Every little corner of the dog porch, they hadn't touched another thing. It was just a statement about the dogs. And of course, they did it while the dogs were like pressing their noses up on the kitchen window watching them. So they got their own space after that. The message was received, and they got their own little area that they could be free of the dogs.
Well, I mean, you probably learned what you would have learned if you would have had kids for the first few years.
That's right.
There's just a lot of that. So I want to make sure we talk about the wildfire. The biggest chapter in the book is dealing with the wildfire, and I thought the way you wrote that was very interesting. You kind of pull yourself back a little bit. That's not a braided chapter. You pretty much stay with the wildfire and what's happening and how it's threatening. And you also bring in the definitions from the fire service about what these different things mean with the fire. And I thought, you know, you mentioned somewhere in the book that you love jargon. So this was a place where you really kind of dived in to get every definition. But what did that fire mean for you and the ranch, and how does it, what's it mean for you going forward?
Well, the West Fork Fire in 2013 came within a half a mile of the ranch, and it burned 110,000 acres. It was the largest fire in Southwest Colorado's history, and it went on for a long time. It went on for really, like, we were on standby to evacuate for more than a month. And it's funny about that fire essay because it is the longest chapter in the book. It was longer than it is now. And it's like an East Coast, West Coast thing. Like, it was so schizophrenic when people were reading the book and giving me advice about it. Like, anyone who lived in the West or California was like, oh, I couldn't put it down. And anyone back East was like, it's so long. And why do you need all those definitions? The reason that it has all those definitions, it also has paragraphs from the NC Web, is, as you say, because I felt like I learned a whole vocabulary. I don't exactly love jargon, but I love the words that apply to specific things. And I And anyone, I'm sure everyone in this room has had fire threatening them now, in some way, threatening some place they love, even if it's just where you go hiking. And as you know, like, that INSEE web becomes our life, right? Like, I'm a little obsessive, but I couldn't get my eyes off the INSEE web. I was watching it every second. And then there would be a word, I didn't know what it meant, so I would look up what it meant. So I was trying to duplicate my experience of being with the fire and just immersing completely in that world. And what I learned from spending that summer with that vocabulary and those definitions and the INSEE web was that, it anytime I have knowledge, it takes away some of the fear. And it, as it turns out, it's very unlikely that my particular ranch will burn, not that it's all about me. And I know that now because of watching the firefighters and watching who they evacuated and watching what they did with the water bladders and watching what they did with the trees. And yeah, so it was, for me, it was like a total immersion PhD course in fire. And that made me better able to cope with it. And so that's what I was trying to represent. Also, I was having fun with the government language, you know, which is like the bureaucrats, you know, write these sentences that are just jabberwocky. And you're like, does that mean, am I a high value resource or a low value resource? Like, just speak English to me. So I was having some fun with that too.
Talk about the, because a lot of that, somewhere you were actually away. I mean, and you were monitoring the fire from your at Davis and different places. And talk about the stress of that somewhere when you weren't there and you are relying on, you know, what you're seeing on the internet. But then also now, having lived through the fire, having gotten so close and knowing that vulnerability, what it's like to live given ongoing climate change, beetle kill.
Right.
New reality.
You know, it's actually better for, like, for me, the unknown is always worse than the known. And in fact, in my actual physical circumstance, we at one point had fire on three sides of us. And so that's burned. Like, I have this ring of protection around Antelope Park, which is the big park that my ranch is a small piece of. Because the two fires were going to merge, and they were going to merge right behind us. So literally, it would be highly unlikely that we would have another mega fire in my lifetime because of that burned area. I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, I'm cavalier about it. I think a lot of this state is going to burn, you know, because we have all those dead matchsticks sitting up on lightning zones, you know. For me, you know, I spent a lot of time before it actually happened or while it was happening thinking, how am I going to live in this burn scar? And then, you know, realizing the burn scar is quite beautiful and the forest remaking itself is quite beautiful. And it really is like just one more example where nature sort of cleans up its own mess and ours. You know, it's beautiful what's happening in there. The aspen, you know, the aspen forests are coming back into what was a spruce forest, and there's going to be new meadows, and I love a meadow. So, you know, again, I mean, the if you look at it through one lens, absolutely, we're doomed. Like, the whole West is going to burn. There's not going to be any trees left, and that's probably a truth. On the other hand, the Earth has this way of renewing itself, regardless of us, probably quicker without us, and so there's some version of hope in that.
All right, so we're going to have to wrap this part up in a second, and then we'll take some questions. But I do have a question for you, not exactly on this book, but I wanted to ask you, because we talked about this a few months ago, some of the initial reviews, which were positive for Cowboys Are My Weakness, seem much different now. Like, you were getting all these kind of sexist, well, in hindsight, you know, 25 years later, seem much different. I wonder if you could share a little bit of that with us and just your thoughts on those, some of those critiques now.
You know, I that's something that my editor said to me too. She wanted me to like write a piece about all the shitty things that were said about Cowboys by way of praising it. I, you know,
that was then, this is now. You know, I love, you know, I love John Irving. You know, like I actually think Rabbit Run is a pre-feminist book. But I mean, that's another conversation. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I try to be really conscious of the time that things were said.
So you're okay with that?
They took it off the new edition, you might have noticed. Here are some of the things that he's talking about. The classic one that made it onto like three different covers over the years was, these are the kinds of stories that might have emerged if a smart woman followed Hemingway around. And like, it's terrible, right? It's terrible. But somehow it made it onto like 20 years worth of covers of Cowboys Are My Weakness. And then there's another one about a smart, sassy gal, like a quick run through the rapids with a smart, sexy, sassy gal handling the yours. You know, so thank God, you know, it's sign of progress. You know, right? Like, they're not saying that anymore.
Well, it's interesting just how things change in 25 years. You know, your publisher thought those were great and slapped them on the front. And now you wouldn't even dream of putting that on the front of the book.
Well, that's right. That's right. So, I mean, I try to be about gratitude and forgiveness. You know, like, I do. I try to be about gratitude. That's really... Someone said, so what have you learned from 25 years at the ranch? And I said that gratitude is an appropriate response to everything. And, like, that's the truth. So I'm not going to write that piece about those people who said those crazy things, because they didn't... I mean, I was there. I didn't love the Hemingway one, but it didn't seem awful to me at the time.
It's better than a bad review.
Sure. Sure, exactly.